Hello, welcome to our Cogit podcast series and this podcast in particular. My name is Anthony Richards and I'm the editorial director of Cogit. The intention of this podcast series is to discuss particular themes and issues of contemporary relevance within terrorism and counterterrorism. And today's theme revolves around attitudes to Muslims in Britain, to Muslim communities in Britain, and the potential implications this might have for cross-community conversations and discussions on terrorism and counter-terrorism. Now, I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor Maria Sobolewska. She works on the political integration and representation of ethnic minorities in Britain and on public perceptions of ethnicity, as well as also the framing of public opinion of British Muslims. She has very recently published and co-authored with Rob Ford the book on Brexitland, Identity, Diversity, and the Reshaping of British Politics, which was published through Cambridge University Press just last year. So Maria, a very warm welcome to you and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure, it's a pleasure. So, the first question then, in light of the recent publication of your book, when you refer to identity politics culture wars, what do you mean by culture wars and how do they manifest themselves?
So many people associate this phrase culture war with America in the 1960s and since, and a kind of era of Trump fanning these cultures, culture wars up. But actually, it is a very old term relating to the conflicts in 19th century Germany over who gets to educate people. And of course, as we know, education is linked to values. The kinds of values that we hold are very much related to the level of education and the style of education that we receive. And this is extremely relevant because one of the main kind of premises of the book is that as our societies have become much more educated, so almost half of today's young people go to university, as opposed to 7% in the 1970s, their political values have changed. And so what we are now facing is reshaping our politics that used to be around questions of class and economics into a conversation about values. And one of these values is, of course, ethnic diversity and ethno-religious diversity. How do we accommodate difference? How do we accommodate minorities, such as British Muslims, for example?
Excellent. No, thank you very much for that. In the context of culture wars, where does the potential emergence of jihadist extremism lie in all of this?
So there's a lot of research linking radicalization and especially radicalization of native-born Muslim, especially young men, to this idea of the kind of contrast that they have between being born in Britain and feeling British and the kind of reception that they get from the wider society. So if they feel rejected, they feel there's a lot of discrimination, they feel that they aren't admitted as full members of the polity, they are then turning to those alternative value sets and alternative authorities. So they abandon the authority of the British state and British values, and they go on to espouse quite extremist, as we know, jihadist and Islamic philosophies and values. And I think in a society in which we are increasingly talking about those values that are against diversity, we have exposed ourselves to this pattern of radicalization becoming more frequent, I feel. And especially one of the big things that we have seen after Brexit, and this is what we're calling Brexit land, right? It's this land after Brexit, after the aftermath of the referendum. What we see is that certain positions that were absolutely relegated to minority political parties and quite extreme political parties have now started to be expressed by mainstream political parties. And what we see over time is that rejection of diversity as a social good is definitely becoming extremely linked with partisanship. So we do see that people who maybe would have been a little bit less forthcoming with their views against diversity, a little less forthcoming with rejecting Muslims as fully part of Britain, they are now emboldened to say those things because they can see mainstream politicians saying such things.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. That's very interesting. I mean, do you think, you know, this general context that you portrayed there, is it a bit of a stretch to say that, you know, there are kind of potential origins of jihadist extremism and terrorism that might emanate from this as a factor?
So we do think that as the conversation about how Britain defines itself, a lot of these conversations have become about ethnic diversity and the place that ethnically different and certainly religiously different kind of minorities to the usual Anglo-Saxon, Anglican majority, how they are accommodated has everything to do with how those people will perceive whether they are a part of the British project or whether they think they have to carve out a new identity, a new place for themselves. And of course, if we do think that they receive the message they're not part of the British project, they will be then more vulnerable to those messages of, well, maybe the British project is wrong, and maybe you have to do something to overthrow the British project. So there is actually a very interesting line of research comparing jihadi radicalization to what has happened in Northern Ireland and that kind of feeling of separation and segregation of the two religious groups has influenced through this process of othering almost the line of thinking that it was okay to attack those others because they were on the wrong side of the value divide. They rejected you, so why should you be loyal to them? Why should you have a sense of commonality and belonging?
Yeah, so thank you. I mean, do you think some of this ties into the literature on suspect communities?
So I do think this is a double-edged sword, I think, with those kinds of narratives, right? So I think the more we treat certain communities as suspect, the more we risk alienating them and the more we risk those kinds of narratives, right? But on the other hand, I also think we have to think, and maybe rephrasing it from suspect communities to vulnerable communities is important because, of course, it is very important in a today's politics where we feel some people might feel alienated and might feel rejected, that we do actually proactively engage with them and reach out to them, right? As you yourself have started this national conversation, it is very important that the conversation includes everybody and it's open to everybody. And so, yeah. I'm sure you know more about this than I do.
No. Thank you very much for that. In the contribution that you made to the book, very kindly, on jihadist terror, you noted deteriorating public attitudes towards Muslims. And indeed, I think you suggested that they were the most prejudiced against group in the UK. And you need the you emphasised, I think, in that chapter as well, the need for research on the social responsibility of media reporting. I'm just wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a little further on how such attitudes towards Muslims might be improved in general, and perhaps more particularly, in what ways the media can be more socially responsible in its reporting.
So it is definitely one of those extremely difficult problems, right, to improve attitudes towards a certain community. But what we see when we look at attitudes towards various communities of kind of minority religious or minority ethnic origin is that over time they do become more positive. And I think that is the familiarity effect, right? That we see growing intermarriage, intermingling of communities. And we do see that those communities that might have initially in the 1950s or 60s been thought of as threatening are no longer threatening because new generations are growing up with that diversity. And this really singles Muslims out because this is the only group that has seen a deterioration in those attitudes instead of this kind of progressive liberalization. And I think it's almost magnifies the effect of what I spoke about before, this othering, that not only are British Muslims feeling under pressure, but also in contrast with other ethnic and religious groups, they are the most under pressure. This has been already observed before Brexit, but as I optimistically called in that chapter, I felt that this could be changed by trying to influence the media narratives around that. But I must say, I am less optimistic now about whether we can even talk about media responsibility when in fact we have politicians who don't take that responsibility. And again, as I said before, the mainstream politicians now, rather than the extremist politicians, who are saying openly very Islamophobic things. And of course, the media will take their cues from politicians. In the book, actually, and this is, I think, very relevant to this problem, we discuss the case of Scotland as a nation that has managed to move towards becoming more nationalistic. So you'd think that's a, you know, ethnocentric attitude, but actually they have created this sense of Scottishness open to all. And in fact, we don't see such strong correlation between having voted, for example, for Scottish independence and disliking immigrants and disliking Muslims. So there is a way in which politicians can change those narratives and become more inclusive. In contrast to what I said in the chapter, I think I'd start with politicians now rather than the media.
Yes, and I guess you're suggesting that this is a reflection of the more polarised environment we live in, perhaps these days in that sense.
Absolutely, yeah. I guess the problem with polarisation is that it offers a very strong incentive for politicians to lean into those attitudes. In polarised debates, the middle ground, even if that middle ground is actually the majority of our population, it gets silenced in a way. And we can only hear the more extreme versions, right? So we see, on the one hand, the kinds of narratives that really alienate quite a lot of our population, which are on the kind of progressive left, about how even being anti-immigration can be a racist kind of attitude in itself. And then on the other side of that polarized debate, we have people openly saying very Islamophobic things. And so even though most of us are in the middle, we don't have a voice in that debate anymore. And those extremes are fighting with each other. And then, of course, this is a debate that isn't inclusive by definition. Polarization excludes that inclusivity.
Yeah. You think, Maria, do you think these sort of deteriorating attitudes towards Muslims, you think, and I guess you've implied this already, that lends itself to perhaps people being more willing to buy into more extremist narratives? Do you think that is the case?
Yeah, so there is quite a lot of research into radicalization that would argue that this is one of the big predictors of why would an individual radicalize, and especially, as I said, in the kind of native-born people already born in this country who would have assumed that they would have the entitlement to be treated equally and be considered a full member of the British society. And through the process of growing up in a society that does in fact reject them, they do develop this kind of relative gap between their expectations and the reality. Yeah. And we see actually that on a much smaller scale amongst a lot of minorities in this country. And that normally means that they are more likely to vote Labour, for example. They are much more likely to engage in non-electoral politics like protests and boycotts and all sorts of things. So for Muslims, because that gap between the expectations of being treated as equal and the reality that they are experiencing is just much larger. So even though the risk is still, of course, quite small in terms of numbers of those who will be radicalized, this risk is much greater.
Yeah. I mean, do you think this also has an impact on cooperation against terrorism within Muslim communities as well? Do you think this makes cooperation more difficult?
I think so. I mean, the best that we can do against terrorism, and again, you have much better specialists on actual prevention of terrorism on your COGIT team. But generally speaking, there is a lot of need for buy-in from those communities. And of course, if the community feels alienated and rejected, that buy-in will be much smaller.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think, I mean, in your chapter, you also raised perhaps a concern about leadership within Muslim communities and how perhaps Muslims are represented effectively by the leadership. Would you like to sort of elaborate a little bit further on that, especially in the context of the conversation we just had about polarization and who's doing the talking? Is there a silent majority? How does this manifest itself in any way within Muslim communities and the leadership issue there?
Yes, so this has been an idea that has been documented in Britain for quite a while, that a lot of claim to represent Muslims were kind of issued by organizations that were either linked with specific organizations that were quite religious. And of course, there were issues with, you know, how extremely religious they were and how traditionalist they were. But also we had the umbrella body that was aiming to overturn this problem and improve the situation. But actually, the kind of the link between that umbrella body, the Muslim Council of Britain, and the on the ground engagement of British Muslims with those organizations hasn't been perfect, right? So when we and we very rarely have polls of British Muslims nowadays because of the cost and the kind of perceived lack of interest in this area as a research area anymore. But the truth is that what we have from data would suggest that not only are Muslims not really engaging with those kinds of, and they don't recognize those representatives often, but also ever since the austerity agenda, we have actually seen a shrinking number of civic organizations that could have represented and would have improved the representation of Muslims, right? So we replaced a funding structure that actually funded those organizations on the local level quite efficiently to this disembodied big society that, you know, doesn't provide state funding for those particular organizations. And so we have seen the shrinking of the civil society in some of these areas.
Yeah, thank you. I suppose the final question, and it's looking ahead, do you see, you said you sort of you went from optimistic to pessimistic since publication of the chapter, do you foresee a scenario in the future in a post-Brexit UK where some of these issues to do with attitude can be improved, and do you see any room for optimism perhaps once the dust settles after Brexit?
Yes, I do think, first of all, I mean, one of the kind of characteristics of identity politics is that they are relatively short-lived. So one of the big reasons why they are short-lived is because they are only getting activated around specific issues. And of course, immigration has been that specific issue from about mid-2000s in Britain. And that issue has reached a certain culmination with Brexit. And even though the kind of fallout of the referendum has been negative in a sense that those polarizing narratives became mainstream and dominated our politics, they are likely to fizzle out, I think. And of course, when we think about attitudinal change, we think about long-term generational change. And here I am optimistic in a sense that our young people are less prejudiced against people who their grandfathers and grandmothers would have construed as others. And even here in Manchester, my children certainly go to very diverse schools and have a lot of positive contact with Muslim communities. And that is the answer.
Great. Well, Maria, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and your expertise. It's very interesting indeed. Thanks again very much.
And thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.